The atmosphere processing system has been a nightmare from day one. When you're going 100+ years on only the air you can bring with you, the loss tolerances are stricter than usual. Sometimes it's difficult to impress the importance of fine details on the contractors. I was enjoying the view, Holden said, gesturing at the screen. I'm starting to wonder if we'll be able to get it done on schedule. Why? Fred sighed and leaned his chair back with a squeak. It's the war between Mars and the Belt. Material shortages, then? Not just that. Pirate castes claiming to speak for the OPA are working into a frenzy. Belt prospectors with homemade torpedo launchers are firing on Martian warships. They get wiped out in response, but every now and then one of those torpedoes hits and kills a few Martians. Which means Mars starts shooting first. Fred nodded, and then got up and started pacing the room. And then even honest citizens on legitimate business start getting worried about going out of the house, he said. We've had over a dozen late shipments so far this month, and I'm worried it will stop being delays and start being cancellations. You know, I've been thinking about the same thing, Holden said. Fred acted as though he hadn't heard. I've been on that bridge, Fred said. Unidentified ship coming on you and a decision to make. No one wants to press the button. I've watched a ship get bigger and bigger on the scope while my finger was on the trigger. I remember begging them to stop. Holden said nothing. He'd seen it too. There was nothing to say. Fred let the silence hang in the air for a moment, then shook his head and straightened up. I need to ask you a favor, Fred said. You can always ask, Fred. You've paid for that much, Holden replied. I need to borrow your ship. The Rossi? Holden said. Why? I need to have something picked up and delivered here. And I need a ship that can stay quiet and run past Martian picket ships if it needs to. The Rocinante is definitely the right ship, then. But that didn't answer my question. Why? Fred turned his back to Holden and looked at the view screen. The nose of the Nauvoo was just vanishing from sight. The view turned to the flat, star-speckled black of forever. I need to pick someone up on Eros, he said. Someone important. I've got people who can do it, but the only ships we've got are light freighters and a couple of small shuttles. Nothing that can make the trip quickly enough, or have a hope of running away if trouble starts. Does this person have a name? I mean, you keep saying you don't want to fight, but the other unique thing about my ship is that it's the only one here with guns. I'm sure the OPA has a whole list of things they'd like blown up. You don't trust me. Nope. Fred turned back around and gripped the back of his chair. His knuckles were white. Holden wondered if he'd gone too far. Look, Holden said. You talk a good game about peace and trials and all that. You disavow the pirate castes. You have a nice station filled with nice people. I have every reason to believe you are what you say you are. But we've been here 3 days, and the first time you tell me about your plans, you ask to borrow my ship for a secret mission. Sorry. If I'm part of this, I get full access. No secrets. Even if I knew for a fact, which I don't, that you had nothing but good intentions, I still wouldn't go along with the cloak and dagger bullshit. Fred stared at him for a few seconds, then came around his chair and sat down. Holden found he was tapping his fingers on his thigh nervously and forced himself to stop. Fred's eyes flicked down at Holden's hand, and then back up. He continued to stare. Holden cleared his throat. Look, you're the big dog here. Even if I didn't know who you used to be, you'd scare the shit out of me, so don't feel the need to prove it. But no matter how scared I am not backing down on this. Fred's hoped-for laughter didn't come. Holden tried to swallow without gulping.
I bet every captain you ever flew under thought you were a gigantic pain in the ass, Fred said finally.
I believe my record reflects that, Holden said, trying to hide his relief.
I need to fly to Eros and find a man named Lionel Polanski, and then bring him back to Tycho.
That's only a week out if we push, Holden said, doing the math in his head.
The fact that Lionel doesn't actually exist complicates the mission.
Yeah, okay, now I'm confused, Holden agreed.
You wanted in?
Fred said, the words taking on a quiet ferocity.
Now you're in.
Lionel Polanski exists only on paper and owns things that Mr. Tycho doesn't want to own, including a courier ship called the Scopuli.
Holden leaned forward in his chair, his face intense.
You now have my undivided attention, he said. The non-existent owner of the Scopuli checked into a flophouse on one of the shit levels of Eros. We only just got the message. We have to work on the assumption that whoever got the room knows our operations intimately, needs help, and can't ask for it openly.
We can leave in an hour, Holden said breathlessly. Fred held up his hands in a gesture that was surprisingly belter for an Earthman.
When, Fred asked, did this turn into you leaving?
I won't loan my ship, but I'll definitely rent it out. My crew and I were talking about getting jobs, actually.
Hire us. Deduct whatever's fair for services you've already rendered.
No, Fred said. I need you.
You don't, Holden replied. You need our depositions.
And we're not going to sit here waiting a year or two for sanity to reign.
We'll all do video depositions, sign whatever affidavits you want us to as to their authenticity. But we're leaving to find work one way or the other. You might as well make use of it.
No, Fred said. You're too valuable to take risks with your lives.
What if I throw in the data cube the captain of the Doniger was trying to liberate?
The silence was back, but it had a different feel to it.
Look, Holden said, pressing on. You need a ship like the Rossi. I've got one. You need a crew for her. I've got that too. And you're as hungry to know what's on that cube as I am.
I don't like the risk.
Your other option is to throw us in the brig and commandeer the ship. There's some risks in that, too.
Fred laughed. Holden felt himself relax.
You still have the same problem that brought you here, Fred said. Your ship looks like a gunship, no matter what its transponder is saying.
Holden jumped up and grabbed a piece of paper from Fred's desk. He started writing on it with a pen snatched from a decorative pen set.
I've been thinking about that. You've got full manufacturing facilities here, and we're supposed to be a light gas freighter.
So, he said as he sketched a rough outline of the ship,
we weld on a bunch of empty compressed gas storage tanks in two bands around the hull. Use them to hide the tubes. Repaint the whole thing. Weld on a few projections to break up the hull profile and hide us from ship recognition software. It'll look like shit and screw up the aerodynamics, but we won't be near Atmo anytime soon. It'll look exactly like what it is. Something a bunch of belters slapped together in a hurry.
He handed the paper to Fred. Fred began laughing in earnest, either at the terrible drawing or at the absurdity of the whole thing.
You could give a pirate a hell of a surprise, he said. If I do this, you and your crew will record my depositions and hire on as an independent contractor for errands like the Eros run, and appear on my behalf when the peace negotiations start?
Yes.
I want the right to outbid anyone else who tries to hire you. No contracts without my counteroffer.
Holden held out his hand, and Fred shook it.
Nice doing business with you, Fred.
As Holden left the office, Fred was already on the comm with his machine shop people.
Holden pulled out his portable terminal and called up Naomi.
Yeah, she said.
Pack up the kids. We're going to Eros.
Chapter 22. Miller. The people mover to Eros was small, cheap, and overcrowded. The air recyclers had the plastic and resin smell of long-life industrial models that Miller associated with warehouses and fuel depots. The lights were cheap LEDs, tinted a false pink that was supposed to flatter the complexion, but instead made everyone look like undercooked beef. There were no cabins, only row after row of formed laminate seating and two long walls with five stacks of bunks that the passengers could hot swap. Miller had never been on a cheapjack transport before, but he knew how they worked. If there was a fight, the ship's crew would pump riot gas into the cabin, knock everyone out, and put anyone who'd been in the scuffle under restraint. It was a draconian system, but it did tend to keep passengers polite. The bar was always open, and the drinks were cheap. Not long ago, Miller would have found that enticing. Instead, he sat on one of the long seats, his hand terminal open. Julie's case file, what he had reconstructed of it, glowed before him. The picture of her, proud and smiling, in front of the razorback, the dates and records, her jiu-jitsu training. It seemed like very little, considering how large the woman had grown in his life. A small news feed crawled down the terminal's left side. The war between Mars and the Belt escalated, incident after incident, but the secession of Ceres Station was the top news. Earth was taken to task by Martian commentators for failing to stand united with its fellow inner planet, or at least for not handing over the Ceres security contract to Mars. The scattershot reaction of the Belt ran the gamut from pleasure at seeing Earth's influence fall back down the gravity well to strident near panic at the loss of Ceres's neutrality, to conspiracy theories that Earth was fomenting the war for its own ends. Miller reserved judgment.
I always think of pews.
Miller looked over. The man sitting next to him was about Miller's age, the fringe of gray hair, the soft belly. The man's smile told Miller the guy was a missionary, out in the vacuum saving souls. Or maybe it was the name tag and Bible.
The seats, I mean, the missionary said. They always make me think of going to church, the way they're all lined up, row after row. Only instead of a pulpit, we have bunk beds.
Our Lady of Sleeping Through It, Miller said, knowing he was getting drawn into conversation, but unable to stop himself.
The missionary laughed.
Something like that, he said. Do you attend church?
Haven't in years, Miller said. I was a Methodist when I was anything. What flavor are you selling?
The missionary lifted his hands in a gesture of harmlessness that went back to the African plains of the Pleistocene.
I have no weapon. I seek no fight.
I'm just going back to Eros for a conference on Luna, he said. My proselytizing days are long behind me.
I didn't think those ever ended, Miller said.
They don't. Not officially. But after a few decades, you come to a place where you realize that there's really no difference between trying and not trying. I still travel. I still talk to people. Sometimes we talk about Jesus Christ. Sometimes we talk about cooking. If someone is ready to accept Christ, it doesn't take much effort on my part to help them. If they aren't, no amount of hectoring does them any good. So why try?
Do people talk about the war?
Miller asked.
Often, the missionary said. Anyone make sense of it?
No, I don't believe war ever does. It's a madness that's in our nature. Sometimes it recurs, sometimes it subsides.
Sounds like a disease.
The herpes simplex of the species? The missionary said with a laugh. I suppose there are worse ways to think of it. I'm afraid that as long as we're human, it will be with us.
Miller looked over at the wide, moon-round face.
As long as we're human, he said.
Some of us believe that we shall all eventually become angels, the missionary said.
Not the Methodists.
Even them, eventually, the man said. But they probably won't go first. And what brings you to Our Lady of Sleeping Through It?
Miller sighed, sitting back against the unyielding chair. Two rows down, a young woman shouted at two boys to stop jumping on the seats and was ignored. A man behind them coughed. Miller took a long breath and let it out slowly.
I was a cop on Ceres, he said.
Ah, the change of contract.
That, Miller said.
Taking up work on Eros, then?
More looking up an old friend, Miller said.
Then, to his own surprise, he went on.
I was born on Ceres. Lived there my whole life.
This is the fifth time I've been off station.
Do you plan to go back?
No, Miller said. He sounded more certain than he'd known.
No, I think that part of my life is pretty much over.
That must be painful, the missionary said.
Miller paused, letting the comment settle. The man was right. It should have been painful. Everything he'd ever had was gone. His job, his community. He wasn't even a cop anymore, his checked-in luggage handgun notwithstanding. He would never eat at the little East Indian cart at the edge of Sector 9 again. The receptionist at the station would never nod her greeting to him as he headed for his desk again. No more nights at the bar with the other cops. No more off-color stories about busts gone weird. No more kids flying kites in the high tunnels. He probed himself like a doctor searching for inflammation. Did it hurt here? Did he feel the loss there? He didn't. There was only a sense of relief so profound it approached giddiness.
I'm sorry, the missionary said, confused. Did I say something funny?
Eros supported a population of 1.5 million, a little more than Ceres had in visitors at any given time. Roughly the shape of a potato, it had been much more difficult to spin up, and its surface velocity was considerably higher than Ceres's for the same internal G. The old shipyards protruded from the asteroid, great spiderwebs of steel and carbon mesh studded with warning lights and sensor arrays to wave off any ships that might come in too tight. The internal caverns of Eros had been the birthplace of the belt. From raw ore to smelting furnace, to annealing platform, and then into the spines of water haulers and gas harvesters and prospecting ships. Eros had been a port of call in the first generation of humanity's expansion. From there, the sun itself was only a bright star among billions. The economics of the belt had moved on. Ceres Station had spun up with newer docks, more industrial backing, more people. The commerce of shipping moved to Ceres, while Eros remained a center of ship manufacture and repair.
The results were as predictable as physics. On Ceres, a longer time in dock meant lost money, and the berth fee structure reflected that. On Eros, a ship might wait for weeks or months without impeding the flow of traffic. If a crew wanted a place to relax, to stretch, to get away from one another for a while, Eros was the port of call. And with the lower docking fees, Eros Station found other ways to soak money from its visitors. Casinos, brothels, shooting galleries. Vice, in all its commercial forms, found a home in Eros. Its local economy blooming like a fungus fed by the desires of belters. A happy accident of orbital mechanics put Miller there half a day ahead of the Rosinante. He walked through the cheap casinos, the opioid bars and sex clubs, the show fight areas where men or women pretended to beat one another senseless for the pleasure of the crowds. Miller imagined Julie walking with him, her sly smile matching his own as he read the great animated displays. Randolph Mack, holder of the Belt Free Fight Championship for 6 years, against Martian Kivrin Carmichael in a fight to the death. Surely not fixed, Julie said dryly in his mind. Wonder which one's going to win, he thought, and imagined her laughing. He'd stopped at a noodle cart. 2 new yen's worth of egg noodles and black sauce steaming in their cone, when a hand clapped on his shoulder. "Detective Miller," a familiar voice said. "I think you're outside your jurisdiction." "Why, Inspector Sematimba," Miller said, "as I live and breathe, you give a girl the shakes sneaking up like that." Sematimba laughed. He was a tall man, even among belters, with the darkest skin Miller had ever seen. Years before, Sematimba and Miller had coordinated on a particularly ugly case. A smuggler with a cargo of designer euphorics had broken with his supplier. 3 people on Ceres had been caught in the crossfire, and the smuggler had shipped out for Eros. The traditional competitiveness and insularity of the station's respective security forces had almost let the perp slip away. Only Miller and Sematimba had been willing to coordinate outside the corporate channels. "What brings you?" Sematimba said, leaning against a thin steel railing and gesturing at the tunnel. "To the navel of the belt, the glory and power that is Eros." "Following up on a lead," Miller said. "There's nothing good here," Sematimba said. "Ever since Protogen pulled out, things have been going from bad to worse." Miller sucked up a noodle. "Who's the new contract?" he asked.
"CPM," Sematimba said.
"Never heard of him."
"Carne por la máquina,"
Sematimba said and pulled a face, exaggerated bluff masculinity. He thumped his breast and growled, then let the imitation go and shook his head. "New corporation out of Luna. Mostly belters on the ground. Make themselves out to be all hardcore, but they're mostly amateurs. All bluster, no balls. Protogen was inner planets, and that was a problem. But they were serious as hell. They broke heads, but they kept the peace. These new assholes? Most corrupt bunch of thugs I've ever worked for. I don't think the Board of Governors is going to renew when the contract's up. I didn't say that, but it's true." "I've got an old partner signed up with Protogen," Miller said. "They're not bad," Sematimba said. "Almost wish I'd picked them in the divorce, you know."
"Why didn't you?" Miller asked.
"You know how it is. I'm from here."
"Yeah," Miller said.
"So, you didn't know who was running the playhouse? You aren't here looking for work?"
"Nope," Miller said.
"I'm on sabbatical, doing some travel for myself these days."
"You've got money for that?"
"Not really. But I don't mind going on the cheap. For a while, you know." "You heard anything about a Juliet Mao? Goes by Julie?"
Sematimba shook his head. Mao Kukowski Mercantile, Miller said. Came up the well and went native. OPA. It was an abduction case.
Was?
Miller leaned back. His imagined Julie raised her eyebrows.
It's changed a little since I got it, Miller said. Maybe connected to something kind of big.
How big are we talking about? Semitimba said. All trace of jocularity had vanished from his expression. He was all cop now. Anyone but Miller would have found the man's empty, almost angry face intimidating.
The war, Miller said.
Semitimba folded his arms.
Bad joke, he said. Not joking.
I consider us friends, old man, Semitimba said. But I don't want any trouble around here. Things are unsettled as it stands.
I'll try to stay low profile.
Semitimba nodded. Down the tunnel, an alarm blared. Only security, not the ear-splitting diatone of an environmental alert. Semitimba looked down the tunnel as if squinting would let him see through the press of people, bicycles, and food carts.
I'd better go look, he said with an air of resignation. Probably some of my fellow officers of the peace breaking windows for the fun of it.
Great to be part of a team like that, Miller said.
How would you know? Semitimba said with a smile.
If you need something.
Likewise, Miller said, and watched the cop wade into the sea of chaos and humanity. He was a large man, but something about the passing crowd's universal deafness to the alarm's blare made him seem smaller. A stone in the ocean, the phrase went. One star among millions. Miller checked the time, then pulled up the public docking records. The Rosinante showed as on schedule. The docking berth was listed. Miller sucked down the last of his noodles, tossed the foam cone with a thin smear of black sauce into a public recycler, found the nearest men's room, and when he was done there, trotted toward the casino level. The architecture of Eros had changed since its birth. Where once it had been like Ceres, web-worked tunnels leading along the path of widest connection, Eros had learned from the flow of money. All paths led to the casino level. If you wanted to go anywhere, you passed through the wide whale belly of lights and displays. Poker, blackjack, roulette, tall fish tanks filled with prized trout to be caught and gutted, mechanical slots, electronic slots, cricket races, craps, rigged tests of skill. Flashing lights, dancing neon clowns, and video screen advertisements blasted the eyes. Loud artificial laughter and merry whistles and bells assured you that you were having the time of your life. All while the smell of thousands of people packed into too small a space competed with the scent of heavily spiced, vat-grown meat being hawked from carts rolling down the corridor. Greed and casino design had turned Eros into an architectural cattle run, which was exactly what Miller needed. The tube station that arrived from the port had six wide doors which emptied to the casino floor. Miller accepted a drink from a tired-looking woman in a G-string and bared breasts and found a screen to stand at that afforded him a view of all six doors. The crew of the Rosinante had no choice but to come through one of those. He checked his hand terminal. The docking log showed the ship had arrived 10 minutes earlier. Miller pretended to sip his drink and settled in to wait. Chapter 23. Holden. The casino level of Eros was an all-out assault on the senses. Holden hated it.
I love this place, Amos said, grinning. Holden pushed his way through a knot of drunk, middle-aged gamblers who were laughing and yelling to a small, open space near a row of pay-by-the-minute wall terminals. "Amos," he said, "we'll be going to a less touristy level, so watch our backs. The flophouse we're looking for is in a rough neighborhood." Amos nodded. "Gotcha, Cap." While Naomi, Alex, and Amos blocked him from view, Holden reached behind his back to adjust the pistol that pulled uncomfortably on his waistband. The cops on Eros were pretty uptight about people walking around with guns, but there was no way he was going to Lionel Polanski unarmed. Amos and Alex were both carrying too, though Amos kept his in the right pocket of his jacket, and his hand never left it. Only Naomi flatly refused to carry a gun. Holden led the group toward the nearest escalators, with Amos casting the occasional glance behind and the rear. The casinos of Eros stretched for three seemingly endless levels, and even though they moved as quickly as possible, it took half an hour to get away from the noise and crowds. The first level above was a residential neighborhood, and disorientingly quiet and neat after the casino's chaos and noise. Holden sat down on the edge of a planter with a nice array of ferns in it and caught his breath. "I'm with you, Captain. 5 minutes in that place gives me a headache," Naomi said, and sat down next to him.
"You kidding me?" Amos said. "I wish we had more time. Alex and I took almost a grand off those fish at the Tyco card tables. We'd probably walk out of here fucking millionaires."
"You know it,"
Alex said, and punched the big mechanic on the shoulder.
"Well, if this Polanski thing turns out to be nothing, you have my permission to go make us $1 million at the card tables. I'll wait for you on the ship," Holden said.
The tube system ended at the first casino level and didn't start again until the level they were on. You could choose not to spend your money at the tables, but they made sure you were punished for doing so. Once the crew had climbed into a car and started the ride to Lionel's hotel, Amos sat down next to Holden.
"Somebody's following us, Cap," he said conversationally. "Wasn't sure till he climbed on a couple of cars down. Behind us all through the casinos, too."
Holden sighed and put his face in his hands.
"Okay, what's he look like?" he said. "Belter. 50s or maybe 40s with a lot of mileage. White shirt and dark pants. Goofy hat.
Cop?
Oh yeah. But no holster I can see," Amos said.
"All right, keep an eye on him. But no need to get too worried. Nothing we're doing here is illegal," Holden said.
"You mean other than arriving in our stolen Martian warship, sir?" Naomi asked.
"You mean our perfectly legitimate gas freighter that all the paperwork and registry data says is perfectly legitimate?"
Holden replied with a thin smile.
"Yeah, well, if they'd seen through that, they would have stopped us at the dock, not followed us around."
An advertising screen on the wall displayed a stunning view of multicolored clouds rippling with flashes of lightning and encouraged Holden to take a trip to the amazing dome resorts on Titan. He'd never been to Titan. Suddenly, he wanted to go there very much. A few weeks of sleeping late, eating in fine restaurants and lying on a hammock, watching Titan's colorful atmosphere storm above him, sounded like heaven. Hell, as long as he was fantasizing, he threw in Naomi walking over to his hammock with a couple of fruity-looking drinks in her hands. She ruined it by talking.
"This is our stop," she said.
"Amos, watch our friend. See if he gets off the train with us," Holden said as he got up and headed to the door. After they got off and walked a dozen steps down the corridor, Amos whispered, "Yep," at his back.
Shit.
Well, definitely a tail. But there wasn't really any reason not to go ahead and check up on Lionel. Fred hadn't asked them to do anything with whoever was pretending to be the Scopuli's owner. They couldn't very well be arrested for knocking on a door. Holden whistled a loud and jaunty tune as he walked, to let his crew and whoever was following them know he wasn't worried about a thing. He stopped when he saw the flophouse. It was dark and dingy, and exactly the sort of place where people got mugged or worse. Broken lights created dark corners, and there wasn't a tourist in sight. He turned to give Alex and Amos meaningful looks, and Amos shifted his hand in his pocket. Alex reached under his coat. The lobby was mostly empty space, with a pair of couches at one end next to a table covered with magazines. A sleepy-looking older woman sat reading one. Elevators were recessed into the wall at the far end, next to a door marked stairs. In the middle was the check-in desk, where, in lieu of a human clerk, a touchscreen terminal let guests pay for their rooms. Holden stopped next to the desk and turned around to look at the woman sitting on the couch. Graying hair, but good features and an athletic build. In a flophouse like this, that probably meant a prostitute reaching the end of her shelf life. She pointedly ignored his stare.
"Is our tail still with us?"
Holden asked in a quiet voice.
"Stopped outside somewhere. Probably just watching the door now," Amos replied.
Holden nodded and hit the inquiry button on the check-in screen. A simple menu would let him send a message to Lionel Polanski's room, but Holden exited the system. They knew Lionel was still checked in, and Fred had given them the room number. If it was someone playing games, no reason to give him a heads up before Holden knocked on the door.
"Okay, he's still here, so let's," Holden said, and then stopped when he saw the woman from the couch standing right behind Alex. He hadn't heard or seen her approach.
"You'll need to come with me," she said in a hard voice. "Walk to the stairwell slowly. Stay at least 3 meters ahead of me the entire time. Do it now."
"Are you a cop?" Holden asked, not moving.
"I'm the person with the gun," she said.
A small weapon appeared like magic in her right hand. She pointed it at Alex's head.
"So, do what I say."
Her weapon was small and plastic, and had some kind of battery pack. Amos pulled his heavy slug thrower out and aimed it at her face.
"Mine's bigger," he said.
"Amos, don't," was all Naomi had time to say before the stairwell door burst open and half a dozen men and women armed with compact automatic weapons came into the room, yelling at them to drop their guns. Holden started to put his hands up when one of them opened fire, the weapon coughing out rounds so fast it sounded like someone ripping construction paper. It was impossible to hear the separate shots. Amos threw himself to the floor. A line of bullet holes stitched across the chest of the woman with the taser, and she fell backward with a soft, final sound. Holden grabbed Naomi by one hand and dragged her behind the check-in desk. Someone in the other group was yelling, "Cease fire! Cease fire!" But Amos was already shooting back from his position prone on the floor. A yelp of pain and a curse told Holden he'd probably hit someone. Amos rolled sideways to the desk, just in time to avoid a hail of slugs that tore up the floor and wall and made the desk shudder. Holden reached for his gun, but the front sight caught in his waistband. He yanked it out, tearing his underwear, then crawled on his knees to the edge of the desk and looked out. Alex was lying on the floor on the other side of one of the couches, gun drawn and face white. As Holden looked, a burst of gunfire hit the couch, blowing stuffing into the air and making a line of holes in the back of the couch not more than 20 centimeters above Alex's head. The pilot reached his pistol around the corner of the couch and blindly fired off half a dozen shots, yelling at the same time.
"Fucking assholes!" Amos yelled, then rolled out and fired a couple more shots and rolled back before the return fire started.
"Where are they?"
Holden yelled at him.
"Two are down, the rest in the stairwell."
Amos yelled back over the sound of return fire. Out of nowhere, a burst of rounds bounced off the floor past Holden's knee.
Shit, someone's flanking us! Amos cried out, then moved farther behind the desk and away from the shots.
Holden crawled to the other side of the desk and peeked out. Someone was moving low and fast toward the hotel entrance. Holden leaned out and took a couple shots at him, but three guns opened up from the stairwell doorway and forced him back behind the desk.
"Alex, someone's moving to the entrance!" Holden screamed at the top of his lungs, hoping the pilot might be able to get off a shot before they were all chopped to pieces by crossfire.
A pistol barked three times by the entrance. Holden risked a look. Their tail with the goofy hat crouched by the door, a gun in his hand. The machine gun-toting flanker lying still at his feet. Instead of looking at them, the tail was pointing his gun toward the stairwell.
"No one shoot the guy with the hat,"
Holden yelled, then moved back to the edge of the desk. Amos put his back to the desk and popped the magazine from his gun. As he fumbled around in his pocket for another, he said,
"Guy's probably a cop." "Extra especially, do not shoot any cops," Holden said, then fired a few shots at the stairwell door.
Naomi, who'd spent the entire gunfight so far on the floor with her arms over her head, said,
"They might all be cops."
Holden squeezed off a few more shots and shook his head.
"Cops don't carry small, easily concealable machine guns and ambush people from stairwells. We call those death squads," he said, though most of his words were drowned out by a barrage of gunfire from the stairwell.
Afterward came a few seconds of silence. Holden leaned back out in time to see the door swing shut.
"I think they're bugging out," he said, keeping his gun trained on the door anyway.
"Must have another exit somewhere. Amos, keep your eye on that door. If it opens, start shooting." He patted Naomi on the shoulder. "Stay down."
Holden rose from behind the now ruined check-in kiosk. The desk facade had splintered, and the underlying stone showed through. Holden held his gun barrel up, his hands open. The man in the hat stood, considering the corpse at his feet, then looked up as Holden came near.
"Thanks. My name is Jim Holden. You are..."
The man didn't speak for a second. When he did, his voice was calm, almost weary.
"Cops will be here soon. I need to make a call or we're all going to jail."
"Aren't you the cops?" Holden asked.
The other man laughed. It was a bitter, short sound, but with some real humor behind it. Apparently, Holden had said something funny.
"Nope. Name's Miller."
Chapter 24. Miller. Miller looked at the dead man, the man he'd just killed, and tried to feel something. There was the trailing adrenaline rush still ramping up his heartbeat. There was a sense of surprise that came from walking into an unexpected firefight. Past that, though, his mind had already fallen into the long habit of analysis. One plant in the main room, so Holden and his crew wouldn't see anything too threatening. A bunch of trigger-happy yahoos in the stairwell to back her up. That had gone well. It was a slapdash effort. The ambush had been set by people who either didn't know what they were doing or didn't have the time or resources to do it right. If it hadn't been improvised, Holden and his three buddies would have been taken or killed, and him along with them. The four survivors of the Canterbury stood in the remains of the firefight like rookies at their first bust. Miller felt his mind shift back half a step, as he watched everything without watching anything in particular. Holden was smaller than he'd expected from the video feeds. It shouldn't have been surprising. He was an Earther. The man had the kind of face that was bad at hiding things.
Thanks. My name is Jim Holden. You are?
Miller thought of 6 different answers and turned them all aside. One of the others, a big man, solid with a bare scalp, was pacing out the room, his eyes unfocused the same way Miller's were. Of Holden's 4, that was the only guy who'd seen serious gunplay before.
Cops will be here soon, Miller said. I need to make a call or we're all going to jail.
The other man, thinner, taller, East Indian by the look of him, had been hiding behind a couch. He was sitting on his haunches now, his eyes wide and panicky. Holden had some of the same look, but he was doing a better job of keeping control. The burdens, Miller thought, of leadership.
Aren't you the cops?
Miller laughed.
Nope, he said. Name's Miller.
Okay, the woman said. Those people just tried to kill us. Why did they do that? Holden took a half step toward her voice even before he turned to look at her. Her face was flushed, full lips pressed thin and pale. Her features showed a far-flung racial mix that was unusual even in the melting pot of the belt. Her hands weren't shaking. The big one had the most experience, but Miller put the woman down as having the best instincts.
Yeah, Miller said. I noticed.
He pulled out his hand terminal and opened a link to Semitimba. The cop accepted a few seconds later.
Semi, Miller said. I'm really sorry about this, but you know how I was going to stay low profile?
Yes, the local cop said, drawing the word out to 3 syllables.
Didn't work out. I was heading to a meeting with a friend.
A meeting with a friend, Semitimba echoed. Miller could imagine the man's crossed arms, even though they didn't show in the frame.
And I happened to see a bunch of tourists in the wrong place at the wrong time.
It got out of hand.
Where are you? Semitimba asked.
Miller gave him the station level and address. There was a long pause while Semitimba consulted with some internal communication software that would have been part of Miller's tool set once. The man's sigh was percussive.
I don't see anything. Were there shots fired?
Miller looked at the chaos and ruin around them. About 1,000 different alerts should have gone out with the first weapon fired. Security should have been swarming toward them.
A few, he said.
Strange, Semitimba said. Stay put. I'll be there.
Will do, Miller said, and dropped the connection.
Okay, Holden said. Who was that?
The real cops, Miller said. They'll be here soon. It'll be fine.
I think it'll be fine. It occurred to him that he was treating the situation like he was still on the inside, a part of the machine. That wasn't true anymore, and pretending it was might have consequences. He was following us, the woman said to Holden. And then to Miller she said, You were following us.
I was, Miller said.
He didn't think he sounded rueful, but the big guy shook his head.
It was the hat, the big one said. Stood out some.
Miller swept off his pork pie and considered it. Of course, the big one had been the one to make him. The other 3 were competent amateurs, and Miller knew that Holden had done some time in the UN Navy. But Miller gave it better than even money that the big one's background check would be interesting reading.
Why were you following us? Holden asked. I mean, I appreciate the part where you shot the people who were shooting at us, but I'd still like to know that first part.
I wanted to talk to you, Miller said. I'm looking for someone.
There was a pause. Holden smiled.
Anyone in particular? He asked.
A crew member of the Scopuli,
Miller said. The scopuli, Holden said. He started to glance at the woman and stopped himself. There was something there. The scopuli meant something to him beyond what Miller had seen on the news. There was nobody on her when we got there, the woman said.
Holy shit,
the shaky one behind the couch said. It was the first thing he'd said since the firefight ended, and he repeated it 5 or 6 more times in quick succession.
What about you? Miller asked. Doniger blew you to Tycho and now here. What's that about?
How did you know that? Holden said.
It's my job, Miller said. Well, it used to be.
The answer didn't appear to satisfy the Earther. The big guy had fallen in behind Holden, his face a friendly cipher. No trouble, unless there was trouble, and then maybe a whole lot of trouble. Miller nodded, half to the big guy, half to himself.
I had a contact in the OPA who told me you didn't die on the Doniger, Miller said.
They just told you that? The woman asked, banked outrage in her voice.
He was making a point at the time, Miller said. Anyway, he said it, and I took it from there. And in about 10 minutes, I'm going to make sure Eros Security doesn't throw all of you in a hole and me with you. So, if there's anything at all you want to tell me, like what you're doing here, for instance, this would be the right time.
The silence was broken only by the sound of recyclers laboring to clear the smoke and particulate dust of gunfire. The shaky one stood. Something about the way he held himself looked military. X-something, Miller assumed, but not a ground pounder. Navy, maybe. Martian, at a guess. He had the vocal twang some of them affected.
Ah, fuck it, Captain, the big one said. He shot the flank guy for us. He may be an asshole, but he's okay by me.
Thank you, Amos, Holden said. Miller filed that. The big one was Amos. Holden put his hands behind his back, returning his gun to his waistband.
We're here looking for someone, too, he said. Probably someone from the scopuli. We were just double-checking the room when everyone decided to start shooting at us.
Here? Miller said. Something like emotion trickled into his veins. Not hope, but dread.
Someone off the scopuli is in this flop right now?
We think so, Holden said. Miller looked out the flophouse lobby's front doors. A small, curious crowd had started to gather in the tunnel. Crossed arms, nervous glances. He knew how they felt. Sematimba and his police were on the way. The gunmen who'd attacked Holden and his crew weren't mounting another attack, but that didn't mean they were gone. There might be another wave. They could have fallen back to a better position to wait for Holden to advance. But what if Julie was here right now? How could he come this far and stop in the lobby? To his surprise, he still had his gun drawn. That was unprofessional. He should have holstered it. The only other one still drawn was the Martian's. Miller shook his head. Sloppy. He needed to stop that. Still, he had more than half a magazine left in his pistol.
What room? He asked.
The flophouse corridors were thin and cramped. The walls had the impervious gloss of warehouse paint, and the carpet was carbon silicate weave that would wear out more slowly than bare stone. Miller and Holden went first, then the woman and the Martian, Naomi and Alex, their names were, then Amos, trailing and looking back over his shoulder. Miller wondered if anyone but he and Amos understood how they were keeping the others safe. Holden seemed to know, and be irritated by it. He kept edging ahead. The doors of the rooms were identical fiberglass laminates, thin enough to be churned out by the thousands. Miller had kicked in 100 like them in his career.
A few here and there were decorated by long-time residents, with a painting of improbably red flowers, a whiteboard with a string where a pen had once been attached, a cheap reproduction of an obscene cartoon acting out its punchline in a dimly glowing infinite loop. Tactically, it was a nightmare. If the ambushing forces stepped out of doors in front of and behind them, all five could be slaughtered in seconds. But no slugs flew, and the only door that opened disgorged an emaciated, long-bearded man with imperfect eyes and a slack mouth. Miller nodded at the man as they passed, and he nodded back, possibly more surprised by someone's acknowledging his presence than by the drawn pistols. Holden stopped. "This is it," he murmured. "This is the room." Miller nodded. The others came up in a clump. Amos casually hanging back, his eyes on the corridor retreating behind them. Miller considered the door. It would be easy to kick in. One strong blow just above the latch mechanism. Then he could go in low and to the left, Amos high and to the right. He wished Havelock were there. Tactics were simpler for people who trained together. He motioned Amos to come up close. Holden knocked on the door. "What are you?" Miller whispered fiercely, but Holden ignored him. "Hello?" Holden called. "Anyone there?" Miller tensed. Nothing happened. No voice, no gunfire, nothing. Holden seemed perfectly at ease with the risk he'd just taken. From the expression on Naomi's face, Miller took it this wasn't the first time he'd done things this way. "You want that open?" Amos said. "Kinda do," Miller said at the same moment Holden said, "Yeah, kick it down." Amos looked from one to the other, not moving until Holden nodded at him. Then Amos shifted past them, kicked the door open in one blow, and staggered back, cussing. "You okay?" Miller asked. The big man nodded once through a pale grimace. "Yeah, busted my leg a while back. Cast just came off. Keep forgetting about that," he said. Miller turned back to the room. Inside, it was as black as a cave. No lights came on, not even the dim glow of monitors and sensory devices. Miller stepped in, pistol drawn. Holden was close behind. The floor made the crunching sound of gravel under their feet, and there was an odd astringent smell that Miller associated with broken screens. Behind it was another smell, much less pleasant. He chose not to think about that one. "Hello?" Miller said. "Anyone here?" "Turn on the lights," Naomi said from behind them. Miller heard Holden patting the wall panel, but no light came up. "They're not working," Holden said. The dim spill from the corridor gave almost nothing. Miller kept his gun steady in his right hand, ready to empty it toward muzzle flash if anyone opened fire from the darkness. With his left, he took out his hand terminal, thumbed on the backlight, and opened a blank white writing tablet. The room came into monochrome. Beside him, Holden did the same. A thin bed pressed against one wall, a narrow tray beside it. The bedding was knotted like the remnant of a bad night's sleep. A closet stood open, empty. The hulking form of an empty vacuum suit lay on the floor like a mannequin with a misplaced head. An old entertainment console hung on the wall across from the cot, its screen shattered by half a dozen blows. The wall was dimpled, where blows intended to break the LED sconces had missed. Another hand terminal added its glow. And another. Hints of color started to come back into the room. The cheap gold of the walls, the green of the blankets and sheet. Under the cot, something glimmered. An older model hand terminal.
Miller crouched as the others stepped in.
Shit, Amos said. Okay, Holden said. Nobody touches anything, period.